Welcome to On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now, your host, Jared Serbu.
Thanks for listening this week. I'm Jared Serbu. On the program this time, conversations with two senior officials in the Defense Department. Later in the hour, we'll talk with Letitia Long, the director of the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. She'll update us on the intelligence community's progress toward a common set of shared IT services and an idea she's pushing as the next phase of the IC's evolution, the notion of immersive intelligence. First up, though, a follow-up to a topic we've covered recently on Federal News Radio, the Defense Department's decision to update its acquisition regulations in a way that has a lot of vendors nervous. Last month, DOD issued what's known as a class deviation to the Federal Acquisition Regulation dealing with how DOD buys products from the General Services Administration's federal supply schedules. In effect, it'll require defense contracting officers to make their own determinations about whether what they're buying is priced at a fair and reasonable rate. Right now, the FAR says agencies don't have to make their own price reasonableness determinations when they buy from the schedules because GSA has already done that. Richard Ginman is the director of Defense Procurement and Acquisition Policy. He talked with me at the Pentagon about his rationale for the change.
In the FAR, there is a sentence that basically says that GSA has determined the prices to be fair and reasonable, so that when we're placing an order against a scheduled contract, I don't need to make a determination the price is fair and reasonable, and there's no need to document it. GSA does, in fact, determine the pricing is fair and reasonable when they place the contract. The issue I have is when the orders are placed. If the schedule buy is going to be at a unit price of one, so I'm buying 10, do I get a better deal? It came really home to me when DAU professors came in and said they were attempting to teach young students coming into the business that you really need to look at the price, you need to ask for discounts, you need to do these things. And they would point to the FAR and point to this sentence and say, but the FAR says I don't need to do that.
The FAR already did say, though, that you are strongly encouraged. I don't remember what the exact language is. Strongly encouraged to seek discounts. Was the messaging back that even that wasn't happening?
So before I get to that message, it says I do not need to do it. So I got that I'm encouraged to do it. But if I'm busy and I'm overloaded and it says I don't need to do it, then I can fall back on the FAR and say I don't need to do it. Well, they do need to do it. All right. And what I wanted was that sentence taken out of the FAR, which is effectively what the deviation does.
Mm-hmm.
The deviation basically says, look, I expect you to determine the price is fair and reasonable in some manner other than here's the catalog price list. Just take it. It's fair and reasonable. The day after I issued it, one of the people that works for me got just an unsolicited email giving an example of a stapler. For a national stock numbered item, $11. And $31. Well, I got to tell you, I really don't want to pay $31 for something I can buy for $11 for the same stapler. So from my standpoint, it's a simplicity thing. It's a lot of what we buy, particularly in this area, are just standard everyday commercial items. If you have some sense for what it is that you're buying and what its value is, and you go into a store and you see something, that's 10% more, then you can buy it, and it's convenient, it's there, okay, you buy it. But if I told you it was five times more expensive, would you wait until you were in the other store where it was available and buy it for 20% of what they're selling? I think you would. But these are small, by and large, small dollar values. It really is an effect under $3,000. So at the end of the day, we buy 3,500,000 actions worth, and that's not counting credit card buys, just actions worth a year. We do a lot of this stuff, and it adds up. We're in an arena with decreasing budgets. I am no longer in the building up to the 2010 top of the line, and I'd really like people to think about cost and what it is. But I wouldn't expect my child, when I gave them money to go out and buy something, to pay something that they know they can buy for a whole lot less to pay more. That's all I'm asking. Contracting officers do.
You say this is in effect generally under $3,000. Are you pointing to a threshold that exists somewhere else in the FAR?
Yeah,
because I didn't see a $3,000.
Well, the micro purchase threshold. The reason I picked $3,000 is once I hit the micro purchase threshold, then I'm supposed to go look at other prices. The FAR mandates that I go look at other prices. So I'm going to go look at other prices.
So you use the stapler example. Is most of your concern in this area for commodity-type products? Does it extend to services or solutions that are sold under the GSA schedule?
I think principally this is a product-oriented thing. It's a little more difficult to me when you say I have a requirement to go out and buy it, and I'm on a schedule where it's an hour. I don't buy a lot of hour of anything. You know, I'm going to go buy something. So if in fact it's priced, I mean, I guess the issue is if the toilet starts to back up and it's there and I need somebody, I'm probably going to pick up the phone and call the plumber and have him come in and do it. And, you know, so it's a schedule buy. It's whatever the price is. That's what they've agreed to do it. But if I'm not in a mode like that and I've got something I want to go do and it's low dollar value, intuitively in my mind, do I think I ought to go look at, should I have some sense that the price I'm paying is fair and reasonable in comparison to something else? And I do. Do I think it needs to be hard? I don't think I'm asking people to do a lot of work. I'm asking them to use their head. I'm asking them to think. I'm asking them in their mind, do they think what they're doing is fair and reasonable? How hard is it when you're on the internet and you're looking at a stapler to get a second price? 10 seconds? 15 seconds? It's not like I'm saying go do another 20 hours of work to figure out for this $3 or $4 item what it is. So I just pay attention to what you're doing.
So the deviation you issued applies only to GSA schedules. Does the logic that you're applying here extend to other multiple award contracts across government? Should we expect to see similar deviations?
There will be, to my knowledge, I don't have another sentence like that in the FAR or the DFAR. But yes, it does apply. I've got BPA. We do a lot of other things that are against the schedules, for starters. I mean, we place BPAs that are against the schedule. So to the extent that I've done it and there's a price there, it applies. The concept here is determine the price is fair and reasonable. When you go buy something, somehow you run through your mind. You know, when you're in the grocery store and you're looking, the stuff you buy every day, you know what it costs. You know, it's on sale, I'll wait. Or I'll wait until it's on sale because I know it goes on sale regularly. Most of what we're talking about are things that we buy every single day. And if I've bought it before, if I pull up this particular schedule and the range of pricing on the schedules, I mean, there's been analysis done on the schedules, and the price range on the schedules can be 70, 80, 90, 200%. I got to tell you, telling me I can buy it for $50 or I can buy it for $300, I'd really like you to buy it for $50. Now, if it isn't the same thing, I mean, if the one stapler is the swing line stapler that will staple two pieces of paper together, and the other one is the swing line stapler that's got that big heavy-duty handle that you pull down and will put a staple through 100 pages, well, then maybe the one's worth $30 and the other one's only worth a little bit. But if they're the same thing, I want people to use their common sense. I'd be comfortable if they always asked for the discount, if they got past the one sentence. We have a lot of work to do. We have people that are very busy. And if in fact I can do it and it's quick, am I going to take the extra 20 seconds or the extra 30 seconds when I don't have to do it? Maybe not. I'm saying I want you to exercise your mind. I want you to think. I want you to make sure that the price you're paying is a reasonable price.
I think one of the main concerns that industry has is that this is going to drive business away from the schedules because contracting officers are going to be worried about compliance issues, how they document that they reached their price reasonableness determinations on an $11 stapler versus a $31 stapler if it takes 20 seconds.
One, I'm going to buy it on the schedule. I'm just going to buy it from the person who's got it for $11. So if the person who's selling the same item for $31 really wants to sell it, maybe I ought to change their price to be competitive with somebody else. Ideally, what I'm going to do with larger dollar value procurements, and remember that we did $308 billion worth of work last year, is I'm going to do it competitively. So the person who's going to sell it to me for $11, the person who's going to sell it to me for $31 when I'm buying an item by a stock number and quantity, I'm pretty comfortable I'm always going to buy the $11 one. So if they really if they suddenly find they're not getting business, I would argue they probably need to look at their price.
My real question, I guess, though, is that these determinations on these very small purchases, are they going to be subject to audit? I mean, who's going to come through and monitor compliance with this particular deviation on tiny little things like that that happen a million times a day?
One, I'm not an IG,
yeah.
and I don't do that kind of auditing. But what my experience would be with the IG is they tend to go in and look at broad areas, and they sample. I mean, so do I think there's some potential some of this could get in there? Yes, I do. The IG has done an incredible amount of work on spare parts pricing and have found on any innumerable number of occasions that we have not gotten as good a price as we might otherwise have done. And we're moving heaven and earth to try and find ways to improve our processes and procedures to do that. If I don't do this and an auditor comes in and looks, then I would expect to get a negative audit finding that says, help me understand why you bought something for four or five times that you could have gone next door and bought it for. But more important, I'm less worried about the audit, and it's not what a prudent buyer would do, and I want my contracting officers to be prudent buyers.
Isn't this at some level a training issue that could be taken care of at DAU? I mean, if it's
so you remember that's where I started.
Yeah.
It is a training issue and it can be taken care of at DAU, but when the words say you do not need to do this, how does DAU say yes you do? It's exactly a training issue, and that was where we kept running into it. We know what we ought to be doing. It makes common sense that we ought to be doing it. But I've got these words that say I don't have to do it. So you're in a training class, and you're just reading what the book says. It's a legitimate question. Well, if it says I don't need to do it, why are you telling me I should do this? I don't even get to the bottom of the paragraph that says, well, you really ought to ask for a discount. I don't get to it. I stop where it's, I don't need to do this. Well, then I'm busy. Why do it? The why do it is because a prudent person should be doing it. I mean, it's interesting to me that there are other agencies that, in fact, have in print that has not been publicized that didn't take the step I did that go tell everybody this is what I'm going to do and have said basically the same thing, but they didn't say it publicly. I mean, I took the upfront, you know, let's go be honest with what we're doing and took action to take that out. So as opposed to I have an internal guidance that says, really don't care what the FAR says, do it this way. I care what the FAR says, so I fixed the FAR. And I have the authority to deviate from the FAR, so I did. And I might add, I think that NASA has also done the same thing.
Technical question, I guess. This is potentially an interim step before you actually do an amendment to the DFARs?
It would be an amendment to the FAR.
Amendment to the FAR.
It is a FAR clause, and my hope is that the FAR Council will, in fact, see it through to open the case, put it out for public comment, get public comment, and then do whatever is an appropriate action, in which case I pull my deviation back.
Right. Based on the feedback that you've gotten from industry so far, and I know you've certainly gotten some, could you envision making some changes to the way that you wrote the deviation before it goes into FAR or DFARS or whatever the ultimate destination is for this change?
I think the only honest answer I can give you that is yes. Because we get the comments and we do what's appropriate. But the simple one would be just simply take out the one sentence. As opposed to do the rest of what we said, just take the one sentence out.
Dick Ginman is the Director of Defense Procurement and Acquisition Policy. He'll be back with us after our first break, and we'll switch topics when we come back and get the latest on DOD's efforts to improve the way it manages service contracting. This is On DOD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servian. We're back on DOD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbia. Thanks for being with us. Picking up our conversation now with Dick Ginman, the Defense Department's Director for Procurement and Acquisition Policy. The Pentagon's been trying to get a handle on the challenging issue of getting the biggest bang for its buck in the area of services contracting for a long time, an issue that's become more and more important as its reliance on contracted services has grown over the past decade. It's an area DOD says is very difficult to master, partially because many of its own personnel who buy services on the government's behalf aren't necessarily part of the acquisition community. They're buying services as they need them as part of their missions. Ginman, though, says DOD is at the start of a new effort to get a better top-level view of the services the Pentagon buys by creating what the department calls functional domain experts.
We understand really, really well product, how we spend our money for airplanes, tanks, missiles, ships. But services sort of snuck up on us, and we'd spend more than 50% of our total spend today on services. And we're not as good figuring out what we're actually buying and where it is and who's buying it. Now, I have a Naval Air Systems Command that buys airplanes. I have a Naval Sea Systems Command that buys ships. Well, I have no commands just buy services. Although the Air Force has stood up this PEO for services, you know, so they have a very clear focus on it. What we've done at the OSD level is first, Mr. Kendall has assigned Mr. Estevez, his principal deputy, to be the senior service manager. We've looked at the service spend, and we understand, I'll use the phrase taxonomy, but basically how we break services up into categories. And we've broken it up into about 15 domain areas. Facility-related services, one. IT spend is one. Professional and advisory services is one. And what we're asking these people at the OSD staff that have been assigned to be the domain expert for that area is to put a team together of the people from the Army, Navy, and Air Force and the agencies that are their counterparts. And then we'll help them by going into our it's called FPDSNG, Federal Procurement Data System Next Generation. Thank you for the help. To look at, so where have we spent it, and to break it up. And Dr. Carter used to refer to this as the Willie Sutton effect. It's the where's the money. We don't want to go spend a lot of time and effort looking at something that has very little money in it. So where are we spending our money? Where are the variances in how we spend our money? And can we find, so not with the people who do the contracting, but with people who are the requirement. How do you create the requirement? Where is it? How am I spending it? How do I take that? And are there better ways to do it? Or does somebody has somebody broken, you know, the code and it's got a really, really good way? Should we try and migrate others to it? Or maybe we understand that there are three or four very distinct areas within that domain, and maybe there are best practices in each. So I don't know what the answer is going to be. But what we're looking for is to go understand our spend and then go look at within that spend how do people in fact execute under it to get a product. At the end of the day, what we need to ensure we do is deliver the product or the service to the warfighter or whoever's receiving it in the most cost-effective, affordable manner that actually meets the requirement that they were looking for, that we're actually getting delivered what we wanted. So who's doing it well? And let's see if we can't do it so that we wind up paying less, improving quality, getting better service.
Improving trade, craft, and services acquisition has been a tenet since the first edition of Better Buying Power.
Yes,
since that time, have you seen any improvement in that area? Or is it just not measurable, which is why you're asking these questions?
There has been a lot of improvement. I mean, this is a journey, and it's going to be a long journey to completion, and we're taking steps. A lot of our issues and services start and stop with the requirement. How do we define the requirement? DAU has put together, it's called the ART tool, and we've created what we call a service acquisition workshop, where if it's more than $1 billion, I actually pay for it out of OSD funds, and I'll fund it, and below that, the services fund it. But to bring a couple of experts together, and this is a team sport, it's a team effort, so the program manager, the financial manager, the logistician, the contracting officer, bring them together to, in fact, write what the statement of work is going to look like, to write the quality assurance plan, and to write the metrics that we're going to measure to hold the contractor accountable for actual delivery. And so far, we've been doing these now for, I think, a year, year and a half or so, and we're getting, really good marks back. I mean, we've had a couple of people who thought it was nuts. But by and large, the ones that have been held, the people are really, really comfortable that the product they got was infinitely better. We've spent a lot of time looking at service acquisition strategies and improving the approval process for service acquisition strategies. So we've made significant steps in that area. We have created a functional team to go look at how do we qualify people to do service contracting. So unlike everything else we do, where we have a contracting team of people that go, look, how do I maintain the quality of the contracting workforce? How do I maintain the quality of the systems engineering workforce? How do I maintain, how do I train and maintain the quality of the program management or financial management? When you go to services, by and large, I'm talking about people that are outside the acquisition workforce, and there's no one group of people. So that's a challenge for how do we go after that and how do we go look at it. There's been some, legislative language that was written, that was very focused on what's our service spend and reducing it. So there's been a lot of work done over, since September of 2010 when Dr. Carter rolled out what's now called Better Buying Power 1.0. I mean, we've been on the journey for a while, and we're making progress. We just have a long way to go.
Dick Ginman is the Director of Defense Procurement and Acquisition Policy. He sat down with me recently in the studio at the Pentagon. We will post this entire interview at federalnewsradio.com/ondod. When we come back, another high-level DOD guest, Letitia Long, the Director of the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, joins us to talk about intelligence community integration and what she sees as the next phase for the IC, immersive intelligence. This is On DOD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. We are back on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. This is On DOD. I'm Jared Serbin. Switching gears in this half of the show from defense procurement to defense intelligence. As we go to air, one of the biggest intelligence community gatherings of the year is happening in Tampa, Florida. The annual GEOINT conference is focused on geospatial intelligence, but since it's an unclassified forum, it's a chance for the rest of the IC to talk about other matters, too. Before she headed down to Tampa for the conference, Letitia Long, the director of the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, spent a few minutes with us to talk about the event and also the intelligence community's migration to a shared IT environment. It strikes me that probably more than the rest of the IC agencies, you work in a business where there's a massive commercial market for the same type of work that you do. So how does the existence of a big geospatial industry kind of inform your operating model? And this gets to the big conference, I think, that you're going to have next week in Tampa, the GEOINT conference.
Yes, the conference, the GEOINT 2013 symposium, is actually sponsored by USGIF, which is the U.S. Geospatial Intelligence Foundation. We are very fortunate at NGA to have a foundation that is all about our business. I mean, as you mentioned, there is a commercial component to what we do. And this symposium is the nation's largest intelligence event of the year. It brings together over 250 government and industry leaders. It's an opportunity for NGA to learn from leading experts in our field, to share best practices, to see the latest developments, because our government, our industry partners actually bring their new ideas and bring their new gadgets to display. And so it's an opportunity for our folks to really interact not only with industry, but government and militaries from all over the world. And so this is a huge opportunity for us to, again, just the exchange of ideas. Now, as far as, you know, how do we capitalize on this industry that is out there? Hugely, first of all, I don't want to compete with industry. I want to take what industry is doing and either just simply use it so that we can focus on where our value proposition is, which is really the advanced analytics and the delivery of that GEOINT knowledge to our customer set. And so that which industry does, I want them to continue to do so we can take that and make it better, or simply have them do that part of the business, so again, we can focus on adding to it or focus on our very specific customer set. This is really an opportunity for me to update the geospatial intelligence community on the progress that NGA has made over really the last year and a half, since last year's symposium was canceled due to the government shutdown, but more importantly, look to the future and really challenge our industry and government partners on what's next. And what I believe is next after the integration of intelligence is immersive intelligence. So this is really looking to the future where our folks, our analysts, our collectors, and our customers are immersed in the data, interacting with the information and interacting with one another in real time. And so I see this as, if you think about what our children and grandchildren are doing every single day as they're immersed in the data of an Xbox or, you know, other video games, having all of the information necessary available at our fingertips, the ability to interact with, and as I said, be immersed in the data to be able to sense what solutions should be and offer those up automatically and in real time with our customers is the way of the future.
One topic that's gotten a lot of attention at least the past couple cycles of the GEOINT conference, and that's EyeSight. NGA and DIA, I think, have responsibility for the common desktop portion of that migration. And I think you had planned to start deploying that over the past year. Can you give us sort of a progress report on where things stand today, both on the desktop and on EyeSight more generally?
I sure can, Jared. First of all, EyeSight is critical for the future of the intelligence community. It is the IT or information technology enabler for us to truly achieve integrated intelligence. And as you mentioned, DIA and NGA are partnering to deliver the common desktop environment for the entire intelligence community. We started a year ago. We've already deployed 5,000 desktops across our two agencies, so NGA and DIA first. We are planning on finishing our two agencies by the end of this year, and then in fiscal year 15, we will start deploying to other intelligence community organizations. So at the end of this, we're going to have a couple hundred thousand desktops that are the same. And what this means is for our analysts, for our personnel, as they travel around the world, as they work in other agencies, they can get to their same desktop. They can get to all of their data, all of their apps, as if they're sitting in their own office. So it will enable much more what we refer to as teleworking from a classified site. You know, it's hard for us to telework from home because we work in classified areas, but enable us to work from different locations and much more readily share information, which is another part of EyeSight. And that is the cloud developments that are underway by NSA and CIA. Once we are all fully operating in the cloud, it'll make it a lot easier for us to share our information and fuse our information at the data level. We can certainly share information today that's, you know, emailing folks back and forth, but not really, you know, from a data perspective, fusing and integrating our information.
Yeah, good points there, because I think when General Clapper first announced EyeSight a few years ago, which I think was at the GEOINT conference, he framed it largely around an IT efficiency initiative to save money as everybody's budgets are coming down. But as you kind of allude to right there, if you do it right, it's ultimately an enabler for the missions that all of the different intelligence agencies do.
It absolutely is. And I will tell you, when I talk about EyeSight, I talk about us doing it for three reasons. First and foremost is for the mission. It's about integrated intelligence. And we really realize the power of the intelligence community when we are working in an integrated fashion. So EyeSight will enable that. Second is from a security perspective. When we are all on the same infrastructure, we are securing our perimeter and don't have all of the interconnections, won't have all of the interconnections that we have today. So we won't have we've always had to secure the perimeter, but in the meantime, we're also securing all those interconnects. The other thing is, when we're operating in an EyeSight environment, we are tagging data, so metadata tagging at the data level. We're also tagging the people. So our little mantra or slogan is tag the data, tag the people, so that you have strong security and audit controls on who touched what piece of information, who changed it, who edited it, who downloaded it, who printed it. So it's much more secure particularly from an insider threat perspective. And then the third reason, of course, is the efficiencies. We all operate separate networks and network monitoring centers and help desks, and when we collapse to one, that'll be a lot more efficient, and there are definitely some cost savings there.
And there's obviously a division of labor for building iSight. As, for example, as you and DIA go about building the common desktop, how do you make sure that the end product isn't just purpose-built for those two agencies and that the requirements of the rest of the 17 IC organizations are taken into account and that it works for everyone?
Well, you do just that. Everyone is included at the beginning in the specifying of the requirements. So that's a good thing. There is also sometimes a downside to that as you try to build the Cadillac.
Requirements list can get long.
Exactly. And so what we have developed, what we are building and deploying right now, we look at as the 80 to 85% solution. And then for that delta, individual organizations can add on if they need to. But we really think we're going to be satisfying the bulk of the requirements. Now, again, this is for the business part of our operations.
Sure.
When it comes to geospatial intelligence or GEOINT-specific applications, NGA will continue to build those for the GEOINT enterprise. NSA will continue to build their SIGINT applications, and the others will build, you know, CIA, DIA, they're all source and they're human. But what we're talking about is the basic business of email and financials and running our agency.
Letitia Long is the director of the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. A few more minutes with her after we return from our last break. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com at 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servin. Thanks for listening to On DoD on federalnewsradio.com at 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. One more segment with Letitia Long, the director of the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. She spoke with us by phone just before leaving town for the annual GEOINT conference in Tampa, giving us an update on the intelligence community's migration toward an integrated IT environment, a concept she calls immersive intelligence and innovation at NGA. I know another thing that is a priority across the IC right now is finding ways to bring outside innovation into your agencies at sort of cycle times that are hopefully a little shorter than the way the federal procurement system usually performs. Talk with us a little bit about anything you're doing in that area to make that acquisition process, you know, both more agile and create a more collaborative relationship with outside folks like industry and academia.
So about 2 years ago, NGA actually embarked upon an initiative called Agile Acquisition. And as we really tried to streamline our internal business processes from an acquisition standpoint, we rapidly recognized that you really had to modernize and streamline your whole business operations or back office, as many folks refer to, again, the operations of any organization. And so we are doing just that. We are streamlining everything from budgeting to acquisition to financial management to security, you know, all, again, the back office operations. And we're doing that largely through looking at best practices across industry, leaning out our process. We actually have incorporated Lean Six Sigma into our day-to-day operations. So we're looking at how we do business and make sure we're doing it as efficiently as possible. We've also created a couple of virtual workspaces where we can interact directly with industry. And let me explain that. One, we have put our GEOINT analytic environment outside our firewall to encourage small business in particular, but to encourage all of our industry partners to be able to come into the environment in which our analysts operate, see and use the tools that they use on a daily basis, And then if they have ideas on how we could improve a tool that we already have or introduce a new tool, it gives them a sense of where they should be focusing their development on. So that's one. The second is we've also created a workspace where they can register, they being industry, can register new ideas, applications, tools, and our analysts can experiment with them. And so they can get feedback on a real-time basis. So those are just two of a couple of examples that I think are really quite innovative. We're also doing a lot of cooperative research agreements. We do any number of industry days where we bring industry in to hear our hard challenges and what our priorities are so that they can, again, know where to focus their internal R&D, but also bring us their good ideas. And lastly, I would say that we're actually starting an innovation program here at NGA. And in fact, June will be Innovation Month. And we are looking for good ideas, not only from our industry partners, but from our workforce. So it's an opportunity for them to surface new ideas, you know, whether it's on the Jewett side of things or the business side of things to be able to advance new ways of doing business.
Again, that's Letitia Long, the director of the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. She spoke with us just before the start of the annual GeoInt conference in Tampa, Florida. Since then, we've heard from several IC leaders at the conference, including James Clapper, the director of National Intelligence. Here's a short excerpt from his speech in which he says NGA's star is rising, in part because of some of the damage that's been done to other parts of the intelligence community.
GeoInt is going to be increasingly critical to our national leaders as they look to understand the world. That's partly because of what the leaks and the perfect storm have cost other intelligence disciplines. And it's because of what GeoInt substantively offers. GeoInt has a great advantage in our current environment because it is the most transparent of all of our intelligence endeavors. We've been able to talk publicly about GeoInt because of NGA's support to disaster relief, the Associated Olympics, the Super Bowls, and other key public events. GeoInt has played a heavy role in Syria analysis and in counterproliferation. And NGA is regarded as the model of how to support military operators in great measure because NGA embeds analysts with a supported organization. And I can tell you, customer number one has really gotten schooled up on what GeoInt does for him. GeoInt can't determine a foreign leader's plans and intentions, what's inside someone's head. But we can impute plans and intentions based on what GeoInt can portray. Right now, GeoInt is crucial to understanding what's happening in the Ukraine and in nearby Russia. We do not know what's happening inside President Putin's head. That's not a secret we can capture with any intelligence discipline. It's a mystery that would require clairvoyance to know. Too often, by the way, I've found that the intelligence community is held to the same high standard for divining both secrets and clairvoyance. But we have rich geospatial analysis of what Russian troops are doing in Crimea and along the Ukraine borders. And we're pushing to turn this into activity-based intelligence, and I suspect Tish will have a word or two to say about that, to not only know where they are and to know what they're doing, we're turning GeoInt as becoming an anticipatory capability. ABI and its accompanying future overhead architecture are revolutionary for our future. And the foundation for this and the other big idea, at least for me, for the IC's future, is ISITE, the Intelligence Community IT Enterprise. And I know there's a lot of interest in ISITE and where we stand with that. It's taken us about 2 years to lay the foundation, But we're now engaging the mission users in collection and analysis around the IC, and we're ready for the agencies to begin adoption of iSight. We're working on the business plan to allow each IC element to depend on the others for common services. This is a whole new paradigm for the intelligence community where we actually have to trust each other. And we're laying our capabilities across a common IC framework for IT. There are very few people thought we could ever integrate our IT systems, and there are many who still do. But I think we're doing it, and we're going to keep doing it. And I think just keeping a steady pace and a steady pressure will bring it to success.
That's James Clapper, the Director of National Intelligence, speaking at the annual GEOINT conference. Earlier, we talked to Letitia Long, the Director of the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, and before that, Dick Ginman, the Director of Defense Procurement and Acquisition Policy. If you missed either one of those conversations, we will post this full program, as always, at federalnewsradio.com/ondod. That's going to do it for this week's show. Thanks again for joining us. I'm Jared Serbia. So long.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.